I hear the wind shrieking, and I hear the clatter of shod feet, hobnailed feet, you know, along the cobbles. It's so warm in that bed, and so obviously cold outside, that I began to think of these men going to work in the dark. I'd heard my father talk. This night, waking up with the wind, I became conscious of the fact that there were coal miners who had to get up at that hour of the morning to go to their jobs.
Jim Comerford with childhood memories of his father heading off to work in the coalfields of Scotland. Hello, Michelle Rayner here, and welcome to Verbatim, with a life story today involving that most hazardous of occupations, underground coal mining. Jim Comerford was born into a coal mining family in 1913 and has spent his whole life in and around the industry as a miner, a union official and an historian. In Jim's own writing on Australian coal, he records that the first deposits were discovered around Wollongong in 1797, and a thriving industry soon developed in New South Wales, Queensland and Victoria. Convict labour was eventually replaced with immigrant miners from England, Scotland and Wales, who brought with them a militant reputation forged through centuries of struggle against the mine owners. Hewing coal from the bowels of the earth meant exposure to every kind of hazard, from rats to coal dust and terrifying cave-ins. Most industrial confrontation was over safety standards, and disasters like the 1902 Mount Kembla mine explosion, which saw 96 dead, still live on today in the memories of mining communities. The Comerford family moved into one of these communities when they came to the coalfields around Maitland in the New South Wales Hunter Valley in 1922. While his mother missed her Scottish homeland, Jim's father found the conditions in Australia somewhat better than the ones he'd left behind.
He really liked Australia. Well, after all, the mine he'd worked at in Scotland, I went down it later on. The seam was about 3 to 4 feet high, and that's what men were grubbing around. He first worked at Hebben Colliery at Weston when he came here, where the seam ran up to 22 feet. He couldn't believe that such a thing existed. The major crane strike came on and the old man couldn't afford to be involved. Every colliery wasn't out in that. He was still living in that Skillion batch. So he got a job at Seaham at West Wall's End, Seaham number 2. And he got a one-room batch there. He'd work there for the week. He'd walk back over the mountain on the Friday or the Saturday, if the mine worked on the Saturday. Mother would bake scones and things for him with a pillowcase, and he'd walk back over the mountain that Sunday night to go back. He was only 5'2", remarkable work. School, we could look out the window and see the miners coming home first from Pellermain past the school, marching 4 abreast as though they were having a big mass demo with all their pit dirt and that on. There were no bathrooms in those days. Then the Richmond Main train would come in and the bigger mass of Richmond Main men would march through the town 4 abreast, always in the same sequence, always with Billy McBlaine, the miners' lodge secretary, at the head. My father with his cronies farther back. The other thing, the school at Curry's in the main street, would be the band playing the Dead March from Saul, carrying some dead miner to Curry Cemetery. The 3 kids in my school did that journey. They were killed in the mines.
But Jim's own turn came just a fortnight after his 14th birthday in 1927. His family had no economic alternative. So with a new black shirt and new miner's boots, he followed his father into the mine at Richmond, Maine.
We had a free train to Richmond, Maine. John Brown ran a free train from Pella, Maine for us, old World War I troop carrying carriages. Then it began to be impressed on me just what I was going to. You know, I'd listen to these blokes in the train waiting for it to start talking about what they were going to, what they'd been through. Most of them returned soldiers too, remarkably, talking about the Federation, talking about the cooperative, talking about the Miners' Lodge, talking about Billy McBlain, the outstanding Miners' Lodge secretary. And I suppose I was beginning to absorb this while wondering what was going on. Anyway, the train finally tittled off down past the Pella, Maine tunnels. I was astonished when I got to Richmond, Maine, to see such a magnificent thing, you know. If there is such a thing as a beautiful coal mine, that was it. Two-story office, this huge ferro-concrete shaft building, beautifully laid out. Instead of a hole dug in the ground for the colliery dam, a bricked-in rectangle, the powerhouse. In spite of myself, I was impressed. I'm taken into the office by my uncle, boots clattering over the beautifully tiled floor to be signed on by Billy Mahan, the chief clerk. I always appreciated this. I must have looked very doleful because he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Never mind, son, it mightn't be as bad as you think." We had to wait on the day shift being hauled up, and all these kids are going to school shouting, "Hey, you know, you'll be sorry." All this sort of thing. So finally we get into the cage, massive steel two-deck thing, and of course everybody's holding onto the handrail. I'm not tall enough. I've got a 7-pound electric lamp battering my knees. The rope in my water bottle was chafing my collarbone. I'd be about 4 feet nothing at the time. My socks were dangling down over my boot tops. I heard the bell go and down we went. Plunged out of the golden sunshine into this grey bricked-in shaft. That cage used to travel 880 feet in about 40 seconds. Finally, the cage glided down to this huge pit bottom. There's not another one in the world like it. People came from all over the world to see it. Something like Central Station, and all the traffic converged. Peter Jackson, my deputy, took me down to this stone drive section, which is bigger than any other mine in Australia. I was placed before these two huge ventilating doors, and my job was to open and shut those doors as the four-wheelers came in and out with the coal. But the stone drive had just broken away at the time, and there was a terrific amount of air being sent down to it, and it was blowing against this outside door. And I could hardly open the blasted thing against the air resistance, and the wheelers wouldn't help me. I had to do it on my own. And that wasn't being cruel, that was, you know, making me rely upon myself. So I learned the knack of getting my foot against the sleeper in the skip road and pushing with my shoulder, and I could just get it out. Once you get it open, it was quite easy. So 90 times that night, I opened and shut those doors. But something happened. One of my wheelers, a bloke called Pudge Burke, who's died now, had taken his two full skips out, must have come back with two empties. And I was looking, I liked to stand the outside of the doors and look at the brilliant electric lighting at the bottom of the stone drive instead of the blackness on the other side. Pudge came halfway along and called out, "You better come and see this trapper." So when I went, there was a dead horse on a timber trolley being killed in an accident, and they'd cut its legs off with an axe to get it fitted onto this trolley to be taken out. And that's the first time I saw death underground. I saw it a lot later on, but that happened the first night, first shift. Got home, had the bath and then a zinc tub in the kitchen after my ankle, and first thing, rushed to the mirror to have a look at myself to see what my pit black face was like. I began to listen. Listen to those blokes at Richmond, Maine. It was like going to an industrial academy. Numbers of them could hold their own and debate with anybody. At work, in the train, on the School of Arts veranda after shifts, at the big meetings, everything I learned about industrialism, politics, Marxism, economics and sex, I learned at Richmond, Maine. They were so friendly. And the off-face men, that first night, blokes that worked back from the face, maintaining, repairing the mine, and come and sit with you and talk to you, ask you how you felt, you know, and then tell you what it was going to be like, you know. And I got a terrific affection for these blokes. I go out to Richmond, Maine, and cry inside myself, looking at the wreck that's there now. But I can still see them getting off that train, marching over to the lamp room to get their lamps, holding their meetings. It was a great place to work. The first accident I was involved in took place. Scott's Wheeler, Bill Carmichael, ex-Western front man. You could always tell when the skip had been pulled off the raid, that rope would jerk. And Bill used to say, give it three hard pulls of the rope and then I'll pull it back on. So this night, the rope jerked tight, knew that the skip was off the raid. So I gave it these three hard tugs with all the power the winch had. Nothing happened, so I went down to see. He was under the skip, and every time I'd pulled with the rope, the butt of the skip was pulling into his stomach. I had to run down to get the two miners, to get him and get the miners from the other side of the section we were in, to get him out. I hated that, and I felt responsible for it. I always remember, and I must have been terribly agitated. I kept saying, I'm sorry, Bill, I'm sorry, when they were carrying him out. And the ambulance was waiting, and he reached out from the stretcher and he grabbed my wrist. He said, now, don't you blame yourself for this. And I thought it was terrific.
When Jim got his first pay, his father marched him over to the office of the Miners' Federation, and a lifetime membership began. His first experience of prolonged industrial action came just a year or so later, during the bitter Rothbury lockout of 1929-30. Profits were falling at this time, and the bosses tried to force a 12.5% cut in wages. When the union resisted, 10,000 miners across the Hunter Valley were locked out. Production was halted from February to December, when the Conservative Premier of New South Wales decided to reopen the mine at Rothbury with non-union labour. The Miners' Federation had had enough.
These huge meetings were held right through the coalfields. We were at the One in Curry at the big Tin Royal Picture Theatre, packed out. It didn't start till after 8 o'clock, so those going to the miners who going to church could attend. There's all these sabre-suited blokes marching up the street to the Royal, pretty grim-faced. At that age, all that we appreciated about the thing was the excitement. Unanimously, they decided they were going to Rothbury, and they went out into the street, commandeered buses, trucks, everything they could. We rushed home, got our crib tins packed by our mothers, made a decision at the meetings, actually, that we weren't to be allowed to go, the kids. But in the street between the Chauncet Hotel and the post office at Curry, these buses were lined up against each other, and there were committee men, miners committee men, at the doorway of each bus to make sure we didn't get in. But if you sneaked around the other side, you saw somebody you worked with, your wheelers or so on, and they opened the window and they pulled you in. That's it. We weren't supposed to be there, but full of bravado, we were going to clean these so-and-so scabs up. And the bus had left Curry, and between Curry and East Greeter, there were some big trees that had been laid across the road, obviously by the authorities to try and impede the traffic. The miners got out and made short work of them. We arrived in Greeter. That's a night I'll never forget. What impressed itself on me, even at that time, was the attitude of those returned soldiers, returned soldier miners. They had a big bonfire going. Why, on such a hot night, I don't know, but they did. And there was community singing for hours round the band rotunda in the main street at Greeter. It was all these wartime songs. Mademoiselle from Armentiers, you know, there's this long trailer winding and all that. Of course, people became tired and were sleeping on the ground. I didn't know what we were going to do, where we were going, how it was to be organised or anything else. Well, just before dawn, the pipe band started playing, Richmond A Minor's pipe band. Everybody massed in behind it, six abreast, to march from Greta out to Rothbury. And you could see the light, you'd see the fire glow over towards Rothbury where the Cessnock men were. They were there already. Mischievous as we had to get up the top of the column. The significant thing was it was mostly returned soldier miners who were forming the front ranks of this huge march out. Now, we marched out in the dark. You could see the lights in the farmhouses and so on. We were getting towards Rothbury Village as the sun was coming up through the bush. If you ever go up there, it's in a there's a hollow in the road where the Colliery Gate used to be. There's now a big bank been flung up that wasn't there then, and there were three lines of railway leading down to the colliery where the empty wagons were lined up to run down to the streams to pick up the coal when it was produced. Those three lines of wagons made two lanes, and the bush grow, you still see it thickly grown right down to the edge of the railway line. And that's where we tried to go in, the worst place we could have picked because we were channelized between these three lines of wagons. But before we did that, there's bloody wild pipe band playing and these thousands of miners marching down looked as though they would go through anything. A young, very young white-faced policeman, white as that sheet of paper, came out of the bush, up to the fence, and he said, "You can't come in here, boys." And Sheridan said, "Look, we don't want any trouble with you blokes. All we want to do is talk to these scabs to get them out of here, so it'll be no trouble. But it's obvious there's going to be trouble because the return soldiers could see army tents being set up for the scabs up in the hill inside the compound. And they were paying off pretty violently. This young policeman kept saying, "You can't come in here, boys, you can't come in here," as though it was some sort of an incantation that would turn us back. But Sheridan put his foot on the rail, over he went, and masses of us went over after him. Well, the police came from everywhere, out the bush. Tried to stop the miners with batons. They couldn't. I was in there. Whether I wanted to go advance or not, I had to get, you know, the pressure of everybody behind. It's quite evident that those police with batons weren't going to hold those blokes. You know, you can't describe the noise that was going on. There were miners and police fighting hand to hand. You forced down, you saw things. An old bloke, must have been in his 70s, policeman heading outside the line of wagons, this old bloke down on his knees, working with a baton. His face was a mask of blood. He was unconscious. There was no need to hit him anymore. But the bloke in uniform was obviously in such a passion of rage or fear that he just doing this to the old bloke. A couple of young miners of whiteys came behind him, and he was so engrossed in what he was doing that they hit him on the back of the neck. How they didn't break it, I don't know. But he went down. You couldn't see what happened after that because you're getting pushed forward. Well, when it was clear that the foot police couldn't stop the miners, mounted police came at the end of the two lanes of trucks, battening from their saddles, from horseback, because some of the young miners jumped on the buffer boards of the wagons onto the horses' backs and pulled them off. And on top of all the other noise that you can't describe, they began to get the scream of frightened horses, men being trampled under the horses' hoofs. So even then, it looked as though the miners were going to get out into the open and up to the place where the scabs were being tented. That's when the guns came out, and that stopped us. Well, you can't stand up to a gun with an empty hand. When we were all driven back, of course, the shooting stopped. And you could see people lying on the ground, battened, Some had been shot. Black Bob Hunter had two bullets in his ribs. I saw a kid about my own age, two bullets under the jaw of his skin. An old Geordie miner was nursing him like a mother, crooning to him, you know, he had his head held over to try and avoid the bullets biting him more deeply. There was people lying on the ground, and the police didn't interfere with the blokes lying on the ground being picked up. Some inside the fence, they let people in. If there's anything could be said to their credit that day, that was that they let them pick up the injured people. It's a good job we didn't get through, because it was confirmed in Parliament later on they had machine guns set up farther in and steam hoses fixed up to turn scalding steam onto us. I was running down towards the road, and Wally Woods was running alongside me, slightly in front of me. This thing in uniform rose out of a bush, pulled his arm across his chest, steadied the revolver across it and deliberately aimed at Wally Woods and shot him through the throat. It's the sort of thing you see, you can't believe it, that you've seen it. His blood was gushing out of his throat, making strangled noises, his heels were drumming the ground. I was frozen, I was watching it, and I was conscious of the fact there's bullets flying past me. And somebody grabbed my wrist, who it was to this day, I don't know, and pulled me back up the hill. People had been shot. There was more people shot in the second round of shooting than in the first. I went down to where this crowd of blokes were. It was Norman Brown, and a bullet in his stomach. And of course, we wanted to see it, but the blokes wouldn't let us through. They were as white-faced as they could be. One bloke, a Rothbury miner, said, "You can't go in there, sons." And he said, "He's done for." We heard it. We heard him. And that wasn't good. Wouldn't like to hear that again, that he was going through. At the end of the day, when it became clear, you know, that to keep trying was only going to do us more damage, we had to leave and we had to march back to Greta. And the miners' wives in Greta had set up a kitchen in the main street, giving us tea and sandwiches. Most of us weren't interested in eating, we were too tired. We were in a flat-topped lorry going home. And Les, of course, he was really exhausted, but we went to sleep on the flat-top lorry, and we woke up as it was coming into Curry, and thousands of women, and all sorts of rumours had got around. And I remember scrambling to my knees, realising I was back in Curry, and there's my mother standing beside this flat-top lorry looking at me. And Scots people aren't very demonstrative. I thought as much of my mother as anybody, but I can't remember kissing her in all my life. But we got off that lorry. She walked back down to the house with her arms wrapped around me and told me to lie down while she made me a meal, and I never ate that meal. I didn't wake up for 12 hours.
Six more months after the Rothbury lockout before the miners returned to work in June 1930. Many mining families were in real poverty by this time, trying to survive on the meagre lockout pay. They eventually went back to work for reduced rates of pay, but the vote was far from unanimous and there was much bitterness between former comrades. Jim Comerford stayed in the mines for more than a decade before heading to the service of the Miners' Federation. His latest book, Coal and Colonials, was published in 1997. This interview was recorded by Marjorie Biggins in 1987. Production on today's program has been by Jane Connors and Mark Don. I'm Michelle Rayner. Hope you'll join me next week on Verbatim for Aerial Adventure with Loras Bonney, the first person ever to fly solo from Australia to South Africa, as long ago as 1937. We'll see you then.